Welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lavel, the same man who earned the clinching point for Europe at the Ryder Cup last fall, the same man who had a 96.7% win probability, according to our friends at Data Golf, we stepped to the 16th tee, and the same man, Rex, who is leading the field in strokes gained approach at the Cognizant Classic, collapsed in spectacular fashion down the stretch at PGA National. What do you make of Shane Lowry losing it and Nico Echevarria winning it at the Cognizant?
I you touched on probably the most important part of this. He was leading the field in iron play, and it was iron play that cost him in the end somehow, some way. And we do this stupid debate every time. It seems like every Sunday about, well, did he lose it or did Nico win it? And I don't want to
think this one he lost it.
He lost it. There's no doubt about it. I'm not even going to try to dance around this anymore, because he was laying up on 16. It's a difficult shot. There's a reason why they call it the bear trap. It's a tough run of holes, but he was laying up with the 3-iron. It's the same thing he had done all week long, and he wasn't even remotely close to land. And I know there's a lot of trouble out there, but he's a world-class player.
One ball on the weekend in that water on 16, and it was his.
Now, 17, it was a 7-iron. He felt like he was perfect for him, the way the wind was quartering. To flare it out to the right, to miss it the way he did, never really had a chance either. That one's shocking, but it's really the shot on 16, and he just seemed to compound everything. He just didn't seem to make good decisions after that. He talked about the idea that he just couldn't feel his hands coming down the stretch. It's shocking, because you sit here and you talk about a player who hasn't won an individual title on the PGA Tour since the Open Championship, which has been more than 5 years ago, and yet somehow, some way, it looked like he was going to be completely dominant coming into this, and he really just spit it up. I mean, there's no other way of, well, I guess there's a bunch of other ways to say it, but I'm gonna go with spitting it up, because you always go back to the idea that, yeah, we could probably have a conversation right now about what's wrong with Shane Lowry, how come he can't get it done on a Sunday. You and I were standing there on Sunday last year at Bethpage. We saw him in the most intense moment any European can ever find themselves, to win the Ryder Cup. That was going to get away from them so quickly. You and I have had this conversation before about, well, the Europeans were eventually going to win. If it wasn't for Shane Lowry, I don't know that the Europeans were eventually going to win. He's the one that finally was able to get it over the top. That, to me, is the ultimate pressure of any athlete in that situation. Not only do you want to win it for yourself and your family and your teammates and your country, but you got an entire continent on your shoulder. And to somehow get it done in that situation, and yet coming down the stretch against, this is no disrespect at all, he is a three-time PGA Tour winner, but Nico Echevarria, who started the day so far back, he felt like he wasn't even in the conversation until we got late into that, not even the back nine, into the bear trap. That, to me, was just a shocking result for someone who is, by any definition, a world-class player.
I mean, is this not the duality of man? Is this not the duality of a professional golfer, that someone who stood tall in the most intense arena possible? Keep in mind, when Shane Lowry rolled in that putt to defeat Russell Henley and make sure that Europe retained the Ryder Cup, like, that was in the midst of another historic potential collapse for the Europeans, who had a massive lead heading into Sunday single. So for him to do what he did in that moment, 5 months later, then to author, I would argue, at least one of the worst collapses in recent memory on the PGA Tour is nothing short of shocking. And I'm looking at you close, Rex. I know you have your ring light on, so you have very good lighting. I know that you've applied some makeup as well after a long day, having some fun in the sun at PGA National. You did not get punched out. Shane Lowry talked to reporters afterward. I have to give him, to use one of your phrases, a monsoon of credit for doing so, because he runs hot. We know that. He shooed away the cameraman on 16. To his credit, he did not shoo away the cameraman who trailed him all the way after tapping in on 18. How did he look? How did he sound when Shane Lowry met with reporters after the stunning collapse?
Not going to lie, you did this in Scottsdale. You got a taste of it. The winner's interview is easy, and I love the interview with Nico because he was excited. The runner-up interview is almost always difficult. The exception was Austin Smotherin, who was the sweetest man you could possibly do. Just lovely fellow. We're going to get into that in just a moment. I'm not going to lie. I had two questions written down on the notebook, and I told our producer, super producer Sydney, that, look, I just have two questions. I have nothing else for him. I don't know if he's going to talk to us. I don't know what he's going to say. I don't know if I'm going to walk away unscathed, because you're right. I felt like I probably just need to keep my head on a swivel. Like, he may not like either one of these questions, and I probably need to be.
What were the questions?
I'll get to that in a minute. He as he was walking, he had agreed to do both the Golf Channel interview and it's called Quick Quotes, which is just sort of the general interview area. And as he was walking up, he turned to the tour official and said, "I'm just doing one stop," which totally understandable. Totally down with it. The two questions were this. Shane, I know that's clearly not the result you were hoping for. Can you just walk us through the tee shots on 16 and 17? At that point, I'm guessing he will have punched me in the back of the head or the throat. One of those two things. Like, I fully anticipated that.
And then you would gasp out a second question of...
I would have somehow come to my senses and recovered long enough to ask... I know this is not the result you were hoping for, but for 69 holes, you were brilliant. And he was, if you look at statistically, his lead, everything about it, how long is it going to take you to take any kind of positives out from this result? And my guess is he would have punched me again. I felt like those were the only two questions I recommend anyone to watch the interview that I did with Austin Smotherman, because again, sweetest man, was so happy. His wife is due with her third child on the 23rd. But again, Shane is baffling to me. Against this field, which was, I would say, a historically bad field, at least by world ranking standards, the player on Sunday afternoon that had the most experience by far, the player who has been through so much pressure, you would think that this would almost be second nature to him. We talked about the Ryder Cup. Didn't even mention the fact you win the Open Championship at home with your entire country standing behind you, something that Rory McIlroy, in two tries, hasn't been able to do at Royal Portrush. It's not as though he can't handle the pressure, but in that moment, you could almost see it physically collapsing on his shoulders.
I mean, I know I poked fun at this. I know that I sort of glossed over it. He really does deserve a lot of credit for talking to reporters and explaining exactly what happened. We now have context. We now have understanding. We now have an explanation for what Shane Lowry was actually thinking and feeling over those final 45 minutes. I don't think anyone would have blamed him for blowing off the media and going on Tuesday. No. I'll see at Bay Hill and maybe we get an explanation that way. But for him to then explain, Rex, like, yeah, I had the tournament in my hands and threw it away. I'm utterly devastated. This has never happened to me before. Him explaining that he lost the feeling of the club face after that. It was almost like a semi-shank. He had like 211 yards on 16 and couldn't feel the club face over the last three holes. He doesn't have a choice but to move on. We saw the emotion in his face and in his voice explaining why I think he said his four-year-old daughter was on the golf course on the back nine. He was giddy at the thought of her running out onto the green and greeting him as he won individually on the PGA Tour for the first time since 2019. Like, all of that is terrific. And all of that was because he talked to reporters again. If we're going to rip these guys for when they blow off the media,
absolutely.
And I really don't like to do that because I've never been in that situation. I've never been in the arena. I've never lost a lead on the PGA Tour. I don't know exactly how that feels. And I understand the professionalism angle, and this is part of the job. And this is why you get paid tens of millions of dollars to do this. But I think it's really difficult. I think it's really easy to say you should do it and really difficult to actually do it. So for Shane Lowry to keep his head up, answer a couple of questions and then move on, kudos to him.
And not only answer questions, but you sort of touched on the one that stood out to me as I listened to him talking about his daughter walking on the back nine for the first time. She just did her birthday at the TGL match on Tuesday night that I was at. I mean, it has been a magical week for him, and this was going to be the magical ending. And you could tell that was the ultimate kick in the gut when it came to, this is going to be difficult. It's going to take a long time for me to get over this particular loss because I had it wrapped up, because of the field that I was playing against, because this is a home game, so many other things that factor into it. But he went immediately to, my daughter was there and she was waiting for me when I walked off the golf course. I can only imagine how difficult, how gut-wrenching that was for just not a player, but for a father, a guy who clearly loves being around his family, loves having his family in that situation. It was tough to listen to him, but to your point, not only did he talk to the media, not only did he take that moment to explain whatever the emotions were, but he really opened up the vein and he gave you a glimpse inside. And for you and I, who tell stories for a living, it's really all we want.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Rex. And that's where I think the conversation of what Shane Lowry did on the golf course and after the golf course is one discussion. What do you make, though, of what has actually transpired now? Because it wasn't just what happened at the Cognizant. Keep in mind, it happened earlier this season in Dubai. It was sort of a limited field event. Not necessarily a silly season event, but it wasn't the same stature as the Dubai Desert Classic. But he did have, Rex, the lead heading into the 72nd hole, Dubai Invitational, a field that had Rory McIlroy, a field that had Tommy Fleetwood. It looked like he was going to win. Pulled a pitching wedge into the bunker on the 18th hole. Hit, I wouldn't call it a bladed bunker shot, carried a little bit too far onto a downslope, went into the water, and made double to lose the golf tournament. Again, he spoke with reporters afterward. He said, yeah, this one's going to sting, but because of the stature of the tournament, he thought, okay, I should be able to get over this. I'm playing great golf. I'll have more chances. This one, again, you could see that he was devastated. He said it was going to take a while to get over, but he also has sort of accumulating scar tissue in this respect. He's now just one of six with a 54-hole lead. Again, has won just once overall individually since that Open Championship win at home at Port Rush. He did win the 2022 BMW PGA, the flagship event on the DP World Tour. How do you explain it, Rex? Is there a fragility to Shane Lowry's game? Is there a softness to Shane Lowry's game? Is he more susceptible because of certain holes in his game? How do you sort of assess it?
I wouldn't say fragile. I wouldn't say that at all. I don't think that's the right word at all. And when we talk about potential holes in the game, if you look at it statistically, I think his putting comes and goes. It's not as though you're ever going to confuse him with the Ben Crenshaw of this generation or the Brad Faxon, who we're going to have on later on the show. How about that for a professional segue on that front? We're never going to confuse him for that, but it's his ball striking that you always feel like. We have this conversation about Scottie Scheffler all the time. The reason that it seems like he's in the mix week in and week out is because of his ball striking. If he has a good putting week or even an average putting week, he's probably going to have a chance to win. He's never going to be out of the conversation because he's always going to give himself opportunities with irons. I want to circle back around real quick to talk about the alarm bells. Outside of the Open Championship, and keep in mind he also won the Zurich Classic alongside Rory McIlroy 2 years ago, the only other individual stroke play title he has on the PGA Tour is a decade ago at something that was called a World Golf Championship. But for a generation of fans, probably of this podcast, you're going to have to Google and Firestone. Figure out,
oh yeah,
what is a World Golf Championship? It was that long ago, and you're probably going to have to Google Firestone too because it's been so long. Again, it doesn't make sense. If I told you, if I laid the blind resumes and said, these two players both have three PGA Tour victories. One of them is Shane Lowry. One of them now is Nico Echeverria. You're not going to put those two players into the same category for so many different reasons. One of those victories is a major. Everything that Shane has done when it comes to the Ryder Cup
Europe,
all the pressure that we've put onto that, everything he's done in Europe. But on paper, if you didn't know better, you probably confuse those two for, comparable players. And they're simply not. One came out ahead today, and one, there is no explanation for it because there was nothing leaking coming up to this point. On the range this morning, Dr. Bob Rotella, the longtime sports psychologist who have worked with so many PGA Tour players, he was with Shane all week long. And it's not as though they were having very in-depth conversations. It looked like they were two friends hanging out. Before he teed off this morning, they just having casual conversations. It didn't seem like there was any pressure at all until you get late into that second nine. And I guess if I was trying to come up with any explanation, it was going to be self-imposed. He probably got in his head. My daughter's walking with me. How special is this moment going to be? My guess is Bob Rotella would have told him, that's not the right thought when you're standing over your shot on the 16th tee.
Yeah. He didn't necessarily say that he was looking ahead in that respect. I think it was sort of a reflection afterward. But you mentioned the resume, and it is what it is as it relates to the PGA Tour. That's because, Rex, he has squandered other opportunities to bolster that resume. He lost in a downpour at this golf course back in 2022. He was the 54-hole co-leader just a couple years ago. He's lost a 54-hole lead, not just at Bay Hill, also had the Philly Cricket Club lead at the Truist last year. He let that one get away on the back nine as well. Remember back at the 2016 U.S. Open, 54-hole leader by a couple of shots before the Firestone breakthrough as well. And so there is ample time and opportunity on that resume that he could have been bolstering it. All of a sudden, you're looking at a 7, 8, 9-time winner on the PGA Tour, plus a major championship, plus all the Ryder Cup heroics that he has had. Instead, I mean, there's a dearth of victories, and I think there's now accumulating scar tissue as it relates to Shane Lowry that he's just going to have to break through. It's just I'll sum it up this way: it's gotten harder for the next one. Not just what happened this week, but Dubai, plus Philly, plus the cognizant in years past, plus Bay Hill. All of a sudden, it adds up pretty quick. It's just going to make the next one even more difficult. I'll also go through Rex in the final round, and you can nitpick. I mean, he needed a 10-footer for par on one. He made a 50-footer for birdie on five. He got away with a top drive on six that he made par. That easily could have been a double, if not a triple. Chipped in on nine. Made the eagle on 10. Tee shot on 12, rolled out of a bunker, ended up sticking it to 5 feet and making birdie. It wasn't necessarily the prettiest final round, but I don't think anyone could have seen the spectacular way that it was going to be ending.
He played numbers 9 through 12 and 5 under par. Like that was in my mind, that was the first question I was going to ask champion Shane Lowry when he came to the interview spot, because how important was that 5-hole stretch where you just seemed to separate yourself from the field? You're right about all of the scar tissue. I still believe all of the things that we've all of the notations on the resume that we've just checked off. He's going to look in the mirror, probably not tonight, probably not tomorrow, because he's got a long day as well, but sometime over the next week or so, and tell himself, I'm still Shane Lowry. I have still done all of these amazing things, and I just need to keep plugging along.
Yeah, he has memories of a lifetime, none that could ever take away from him. That's not going to reduce the sting that he's feeling on Sunday night and likely into Monday with another chance that has gone past. How about the winner, Nico Echevarria? You had an opportunity to speak with him on Sunday evening. I love this story, Rex. He was so confident in his abilities, despite the abundance of miscuts sprinkled among a top 10 finish at Pebble Beach, that he told his financial advisor on Monday that he was going to win the golf tournament. He closed on a house on Friday. All he did on the weekend was shoot bogey-free rounds of 66 to win for the third time on the PGA Tour. What stood out to you with not just how he played, but also your conversation with Nico?
The mindset, stepping to the 17th tee. Keep in mind, he was in the group right in front of Shane Lowry. And up until that point, as he's finishing up on 16, he had no idea what was going on behind him. At some point, he glanced over his shoulder and saw Shane's caddy running as he was stepping off the yardage, and they were trying to figure out where he was going to take his drop. But he still wasn't sure until he got to the 17th tee, and he asked, I believe it was Bones McKay from NBC who was walking with him, and he sort of walked him through what had happened. With the tournament on the line, standing on that particular tee, I can only imagine how your head would start swimming, because, oh, I've got two holes to do something special. I can end up winning this, when just probably 5 minutes ago, that really wasn't in the conversation. And he hit what he admitted in the interview with me was not a great tee shot on 17. That's not where he was aiming. Oh. Yes.
Shot tracer was scary.
It ballooned a little bit. He did say, he goes, I hit it solid, which is how it ended up actually reaching the green. And you kind of look at that particular area of the green. Not many guys ended up there, not just on Sunday, but the entire week, because you're never going to aim there. That's never going to be your landing point. But you touched on the best part, that I thought that his wife went and closed on the house in West Palm Beach on Friday. What kind of motivation is that going into the weekend? And man, I got to pay for a house. I got to do something special. This is a guy who needed a good week for a lot of different reasons. He's sort of on the outside looking in when it comes to the signature events and the Players Championship and everything else.
Masters, yeah.
And everything else he's trying to do. And his swing coach was with him Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And he had really good practice days all 3 days. As you pointed out, he's really gotten off to a mixed results kind of year. And the final thing his swing coach told him on Wednesday was, I've never seen anybody hit the ball better. Go out and have fun. And that's when we talk about the sort of the mental side of the game and whatever it is Dr. Bob Rotella was telling Shane Lowry before he stepped to the first tee, that in my mind is brilliant. Like I've never seen anybody do that better than what you're doing right now. Go have fun.
Yeah, and he was clearly in a good frame of mind if he was telling his financial advisor that. I do think the renovation budget probably just expand a little bit after the seven-figure payday.
Renovation? It's got to be a new home, no?
Not necessarily. I mean, okay. It's tough in Palm Beach County.
All right.
Things are much better up here in St. Johns County. I will say, too, Rex, there was the little added detail of Nico now getting a dog because he won for the third time on the PGA Tour. That was part of the deal as well. Hot start, slow finishes. Last seven starts, Rex. A win, T4, T8, four missed cuts. If you're going to be streaky, at least nail down that wins when you have the opportunity to do so. Nico Echeverria now into the Masters and a top 50 player in the world. How about another player who's trying to get to that point as well, Rex? That is Brooks Koepka, who had easily his best performance of the 2026 season, tying for ninth after a Sunday 65, jumped nearly 25 spots on the leaderboard. What stood out about Big Brooks and his week, the home game, PGA National?
He actually looked like Big Brooks. I'm glad you put it that way. He's starting to get a little bit of that swagger back, and that was even before he finished up on Sunday. You could even see it on Thursday when he did not putt great, and I think the alarm bells started going off again because we were back into this routine making excuses for Brooks's putting. I will say that coming into the week, I spoke with him on Wednesday. There was confidence there that clearly wasn't there at Torrey Pines. He was downright uncomfortable at Torrey Pines, and it just wasn't getting back onto the PGA Tour. It was all the conversations that he had to have with the media, with the other players, with officials, everything that went into the returning member program. He knew he was going to have to answer probably some uncomfortable questions. But even at Scottsdale, he gave up more than 3.5 shots to the field on the greens there as well. The difference this time around, and again, this was all about body language and Brooks being Brooks, he had time. He had just switched over to a mallet putter going into Scottsdale. He'd never used it before, didn't feel entirely comfortable with it. Since then, he's had time to really put the work into and understand how the ball is going to come off the putter. He also knew he grew up here in West Palm Beach. He went to high school about 8 miles from PGA National. So he knows this golf course. He knows those greens. And once he got by, I think, again, maybe some nerves on Thursday, he really looked like Brooks. He played his final 54 holes and 13 under par. If he would have done anything on Thursday, he would have found himself right there in the mix. I think this bodes well for Brooks going forward. And it was interesting. He's not in the field next week at the Players' Championship. I mean, he's not in the field next week at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. And I asked him, when do you think you're going to get to the Players? And it was Monday afternoon, man. Like, I want to be ready. It's been 2022.
It's major. Of course.
Was the last time I was there. He actually said, like, the last time he played there, he didn't know if it was overseeded or not. It was played in March back then, but it kind of gives you an idea of everything seems to be a little bit new for him. I'm not saying Brooks is back. I think that would be premature, but this certainly is a good step forward.
Yeah, I need to see multiple weeks with putting performances like this for me to be fully on board. I must say his ball striking has made significant strides, certainly since 2025. I thought on Friday the 66 that he shot was like the worst that he could have shot. I think that easily could have been a round of 62, 63 had he made a couple of 10 to 15 footers that he left wanting. You mentioned the Sunday 65. I think it's hugely important too, Rex. You mentioned he's not in the Arnold Palmer Invitational field. He's not in any of the signature events in 2026. He needs to qualify for them. So this is making a good move in the Aon Next 10, the Swing 5, things of that nature. You look statistically, tie for fourth in greens of regulation, 21st off the tee. The big one, obviously, the anomaly to this point in the season is the putting. 376 feet worth of putts made. So is that a one-time deal? Is that an aberration? Was the tweak that he made with his putting coach, Jeff Pierce, on Thursday night, moving his hands a little bit forward to take some of the wrist action out? Is that sort of the solve for what has been ailing Brooks Koepka? I think we're going to find out. Hugely, hugely important week, though, from a confidence standpoint on the greens. Hopefully now it can springboard to success at the Players' Championship, Valspar, Houston. He's got a pretty busy month or so coming up. How about the tournament in general, Rex? So much talk about the field, no top 25 players. Everyone's complaining about the fact that the tournament, which was once most difficult on the PGA Tour schedule, is now being won at 17 and 19 under par. What was the vibe like on the grounds?
Well, I think the players liked that officials decided to try to put some teeth back in the PGA National. Certainly, Billy Horschel was pretty outspoken about this. So was Shane Lowry earlier in the week. Brooks Koepka talked about this. Golf course is supposed to be hard. And I think the tour took a step back in that they added yardage to the second hole. They added yardage to the 18th hole. They grew the rough longer. Certainly, the conditions factor into that. So I think all of that helps. But when you ask about the vibe, I think it goes beyond the golf course and the golf course setup. I mean, I think the entire conversation all week long was about where the Cognizant fits into the future PGA Tour schedule. And I don't particularly want to get into this conversation right now. Our friend, Tom DeAngelo, who's a longtime sports writer here in West Palm Beach, wrote a really good story, making the pitch, why Cognizant should be part of the PGA Tour's future. And I tend to agree. I keep circling back around to, we're going to have this conversation, it seems like, every 2 or 3 weeks. Because next thing you know, we're going to be at Valspar. And I'm sure we're going to have the exact same conversation. And then we're going to be at the 3M and then the John Deere. And we can keep going down the list of events that may or may not be cut. And I guess I want to go back to the idea of just caution at this point. We don't know exactly what the future schedule is going to look like. Let's give it a beat. Let's see what Brian Rolapp, the CEO of the PGA Tour, says in a few weeks when we get to the Players Championship. Because I don't think, as of right now, the PGA Tour is necessarily close to knowing exactly what that schedule is going to look like. So at this point, it seems a lot like wasted energy.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The numbers are what they are.
Thanks.
Whereas in the last 6 years, only three top 10 players in the world have competed. An easy fix to me is moving it earlier in the schedule. On the midweek show last week, I said put it either the second or the third week of the new PGA Tour schedule. All of a sudden, you got guys who are chomping at the bit who have not played an official PGA Tour event for 5 months. Yeah, I think that's probably going to help boost the field. Remains to be seen, though, if that's actually going to happen. All right, after this short break, Brad Faxon, who witnessed Shane Lowry's shocking collapse for NBC Golf, will join us for an in-depth discussion on that. Seminole Pro member, so much more. Stay with us. And for this Boots on the Ground segment, we're pleased to be joined by Brad Faxon, who was on the NBC call for the Cognizant Classic, but apparently had so many takes that could not be contained in those 16 or so hours on the air. Fax, it's great to see you, my friend. What do you make of that final 45 minutes at PGA National?
Well, I think we were all hoping that we were going to see Shane Lowry jumping in the water on 18 after a 4 or 5 shot win. He breezed through those first 15 holes like it was nothing. You know, a guy that probably had the most experience on the leaderboard, not probably, without a doubt, had the most experience on that leaderboard. You know, I said at the opening, you know, to be able to sleep on the lead of a major championship and go ahead and finish that off like he did when he won at Port Rush in 2019, he had so much success. He had he'd been more under par than any other player that's ever played in the Cognizant, with a bunch of young guys that were just hoping maybe they could get enough points to get to play at Bay Hill or to the Players. And off to such a good start in that run that he had. Lav, when he chipped in there, and Bones made a great call that he was most likely going to make that chip shot on 9. He eagled the easy hole, the easy par 5, 10. Good shots into 11. There wasn't any part of him looked like that he was going to throw up. And after he hit that shot into 15, I'm like, it's amazing what you can do when you hit the center of the club face. And then it all ended.
Now, I want to go through 16 and 17 with you because those tee shots are fascinating to me. If someone who has been in that arena knows the pressure, but you and I were both on the range this morning when Shane was warming up and Bob Rotella talked to him before he walked to the tee. So my question to you is, someone who I think you worked with Bob Rotella in your career, what do you think Bob told him before he teed off? And what do you think he said after he finished up that round today?
Well, I walked onto the practice range right as Austin and Shane were hitting balls next to each other, virtually right next to each other. I've known Bob since my early days on the PGA Tour, 1984-85. I love Bob. I mean, he helped so many players' careers with his demeanor and his thoughts, little sort of axioms that you can use to play. And I know he's helped Shane kind of quietly for a couple of years, you know, like he's helped McIlroy. And he said to Shane, he said, hey, just have fun being Shane Lowry on the golf course. Just something very simple, not extra thoughts. Shane striped every single shot on that range. And, you know, I've watched Shane hit a lot of balls. It just looked like he was in total control. The balls were coming off the center of the club face. Balls were going, you know, high without a divot, which is really a place where nirvana for a golfer. Just beautiful swings. They weren't curving in the crosswind at all. And I don't know what happened. You know, you might have looked early in the round and said, Well, he topped his driver on six, and then you thought nothing of it when he got up and down, made that 20-footer or so for a par after making a 50-footer that might have gone into the pond on five. He made that for birdie. And then a complete collapse. I guess what I would say in the 16th hole, that was Kisner's hole. For on NBC, he does the evens, I do the odds. I think he was in between clubs on the tee shot there. That hole was playing in a completely different wind than it had previously all week. You need to get that tee shot down there. It helps to be in the fairway, but he just needed pars to finish 16, 17, and 18. And I think for that three iron that he hits off, that driving iron, he pressed it. I think he tried to hit it hard. I think he went against his fade shot to hit maybe a draw, but he had to be in what the Europeans or the, especially everybody from GB and I would say, he was in two minds. And you can't hit a shot that far offline trying. You know, it's something you couldn't do in practice. So there was something definitely in his head that made him think differently than he needed to think. And Shane is the most likable. He's an emotional player. This is going to sting. I think, you know, for him, he's had some scarring from the Cognizant. And our producer, Tommy Roy, said, look, he definitely, the bear trap got him. And there's no way around saying that.
Facts, after that tee shot on 16, Shane told the media afterward that he couldn't feel the club face for the rest of the round. Have you ever had an experience like that? Because I imagine that just has to be a place of utter despair and disappointment.
I remember one year, that's a good question. I was playing the Hawaiian Open with Jim Furyk and Steve Stricker in the final round. And it was one of those days where I had no feeling for where the club face was. And the best players in the world have an incredible ability to feel where the face is in time and space throughout the swing. And evidenced by maybe one of the greatest shots in the history of the game, Jack Nicklaus's one or two iron into the 17th hole at Pebble Beach in the 72nd U.S. Open. He had the ability to know that in 1972, he famously said after he won the U.S. Open and that maybe the greatest iron shot ever played, he was hitting that one or two iron on the 17th hole on Sunday. And he said he had taken the club face back a little shut, but he had the ability to feel where the club face was, keep it from closing. He hit a lower shot than he normally does. And we all know what happened. It hit the flag stick and dropped, you know, 6 inches away for a two to win. I've had times where I've lost the club face in that feel and not knowing where the golf ball is going at all. And it's a terrible feeling. The 1996 Hawaiian Open, I played in the final round with Jim Furyk and Steve Stricker, completely had no feeling where the ball was going, but made a 70-footer on the 18th hole to make eagle to get in the playoff against Furyk. And I lost the playoff on the third extra hole. And Alan Shipnick wrote an article that has bothered me ever since, that if you want to win a golf tournament, just make sure you're in a playoff against Brad Faxon. He went into all these reasons why. But for Shane, he was the opposite. He had complete control of everything going on, whether it was off the tee, whether it was an iron shot, a chip shot, or the putter. And then it completely deserted him in the middle of the bear trap.
Okay, I promise we won't ask about Shipnuck the rest of this podcast. We clearly some things going on that front. But give me an idea when it comes to losing an event the way Shane Lowry lost this. I'm sure during over the course of your career, you had some heartbreaking losses. How long does it take to get over a loss like that?
You know, I said to Kevin Kisner that how do you as an announcer, you know, as a former player, as a you know, former competitor against someone like Shane Lowry, how do you pull a Johnny Miller and say you just choked? And I'm sure Shane would say, you know, that something happened where I lost the control of the club face, or I didn't know, I wasn't focused on hitting the appropriate shot at the appropriate target. And he's such a likable guy. And, you know, he made the finish compelling. I don't know how you recover from this. You know, he's going to be at Seminole tomorrow with all of his friends. He's going to be playing with people that he's known all his life that have seen him at Seminole every year in this and have become good friends with him, and they're all going to feel bad for him, not know what to say. And I mean, golf is one of the sports where you don't win very often. And when you do win, it's the greatest feeling in the world. And then you have something like this, and it's gut wrenching. It's heart wrenching. I don't know. You know, I don't know what you'd say to him other than you came close.
Could have been worse facts. Shane Lowry could have been dragged to the SoFi Center on Sunday evening. He had to play TGL 2 hours after he got his heart ripped out down the road at PGA National. I did want to ask you, because the field was such a talking point this past week at the Cognizant Classic, but do you think the way that it unfolded Sunday and the drama that we had on the back nine is almost validation that the PGA Tour needs the cinema that is PGA National and its watery closing stretch?
No doubt about it. I mean, think about, the courses that have, a nickname like the Bear Trap or the Green Mile or the Snake Pit. You look forward to what's happening. And every golfer knows what it feels like to get to a certain stretch of holes, call it the last three holes at the Players' Championship, or they don't have a name, but how difficult they can be and how rewarding it can be and how agonizing it can be. And eat for the best golfers in the world. And, think about what happened in that half an hour to 45 minutes when Lowry walked off the 15th hole with a three shot lead and then hits a shot that you don't even think is possible. And Echeverria hits a seven iron that he cut too much. He wasn't trying to hit that shot. If you looked at the scatter chart of where all these balls landed on the 17th hole, there might've been two short and right and on the green of the 17th hole. And, he put it in a spot that was the ideal place to putt from uphill, slightly right to left. That probably didn't have a spike mark there. There was nothing, and he just jams it in the back of the hole. This game, I don't know, we'll be talking about the same stuff 100 years from now and still never be able to figure it out.
Along those lines, there's all the talk that goes into an event like this, and it gives us a chance to meet younger players that maybe the audience doesn't know a lot about, Austin Smotherman being the primary example here. As someone who was on the call all week long, having the opportunity to tell these stories, how important is it for you to be able to communicate to the audience that there are young players that you need to keep an eye on?
Yeah, you came away from this week. I told Austin on the reins this morning. I said, no matter what happens today, you've already won. People know your name. You've competed against the best players this week and shown them how you can hit a golf ball. You've made tremendous strides. The talks that he's been getting from Josh Gregory, the guru short game coach for so many players, including the U.S. Open champion J.J. Spahn. It really doesn't matter what you do today, Austin. You've shown the world that you can play. He reminds me a little bit about Jake Knapp a couple of years ago, a guy that is good looking guy, great golf swing, nice, polite, that easily likable. And I think this is just the beginning. I haven't seen the final list now to know if the guys that finished at 15 under, will this get them into Bay Hill? Will this get them into the Players if they weren't already in? I know Austin's wife's expecting their third child in the middle of March. So if he gets to go to Bay Hill and can he capitalize on this latest great event for him, that will mean the world. And I mean, I think these events like the Cognizant tell stories that otherwise won't be told.
Facts, it doesn't receive official world golf ranking points, but many of the top players in the world are teeing it up on Monday at the Seminole Pro Member. For the uninitiated, how would you describe that tournament?
Gosh, I've been lucky enough to play in this for years now. I played with Seth Waugh, who was formerly the CEO of Deutsche Bank and obviously the founder of the Deutsche Bank Championship. I had an injury 1 year, and Justin Rose took my place, and Rose and Seth won the event. So I've been playing since then with Tom Ryan, the former CEO of CVS Pharmacy, which was a Rhode Island-based company, and Tom held and hosted the CBS Charity Classic up in Rhode Island with myself and Billy Andrade. And then it's a who's who of PGA Tour players. Obviously, Rory plays with his dad, who's a member there at Seminole. Arnold used to come when he was alive with Tim Neer, who I'm actually playing with tomorrow. Tim Neer is playing with Trevor Immelman. So we got the battle of the announcers here tomorrow. But I think I saw Echeverria's playing at 7:15 in the first group off tomorrow. So I don't know if he'll end up sleeping or go straight to the tee, a la Walter Hagen. I don't know how he'll do that. He's just become a new homeowner. His wife bought a house, signed for the house yesterday during the middle of his round. So maybe that extra incentive really helped him through the bear trap. I mean, but, you know, the history of Seminole, having the great director of golf there, Bob Ford, for years now, capably taken over by Matt Cahill. It's just a fun day. It's a who's who in the business world matched with the who's who in the golfing world.
Now, the Cognizant Classic was NBC's first tour event of the year. Any rust from you, or did you come out swinging?
Did I come out swinging? I thought it went well. You know, the first few days, you know, to see, you know, Smotherman and Echeverria come out with those, you know, those incredible rounds, 62 and 63, and then four shots ahead of the third place guy. That really never happens. You don't see that. You always think of this as a beast of a golf course. And I mean, I think that the viewer wants to see carnage, don't they? They don't mind that. Back home in the 4 feet of snow Rhode Island got, it's okay to see a few double bogeys. I think last 10 years, there's no course on the PGA Tour that's had more double bogeys or worse than PGA National. I think they're a victim a little bit of the schedule of, you know, the signature events, the two before them, the two after them. The tournament in Mexico went away, so it didn't give guys a breather from Riviera. I'm pulling for this tournament. There's too many good things down here, particularly the many players that live in this area. I would count 75 or more PGA Tour players. I think that the reputation of PGA National is it's an overcrowded, you know, resort course that the players don't go and play during the year at all. And, you know, despite the fact that Jack and Barbara Nicholas and their hospital is the beneficiary, I think it deserves more than it's getting.
Facts, where do you fall on this overseed versus Bermuda debate? It's a little bit too inside golf for me and Rex, because Bermuda, overseed, concrete, AstroTurf, it's all very difficult to us. But for a high-level PGA Tour player, a player who is playing on the best circuit in the world, have the decision makers of putting this with overseed over the last couple of years, have they massacred what was one of the most brutally difficult golf courses on the schedule? Or do you think that they've struck a nice balance of still maintaining some of the entertainment aspects that makes this such a great tournament?
Right. Great question. I think what originally went along with the Bermuda rough here and the thicker Bermuda rough and the higher scores, the worse scores, is that the comparison this event had to the Waste Management with what they did around the 17th hole, and obviously Waste Management's 16th hole, and the party or the celebration, it was more chaotic a few years ago back then in those times. And I don't think the best players in the world wouldn't show up because the course is tough. As a matter of fact, I think that drives those players. I just think they, you know, there only needs to be one Waste Management with their success and what they've done. I don't think it needs to be copied. And I think they tried to get that way too much. And then we were told in our production meeting on Wednesday that Cognizant had made a choice early on that said, look, let's make this course a little easier so it's not so difficult for the top players, and maybe we'll get them. And they realized quickly, well, that's not the answer. So, you know, they made some changes. Bigger tee on 18, narrower fairway on 3, higher rough. You know, they went from 3 to 4 inches this week. But the ryegrass is more predictable. It's easier. It doesn't lay down and cause the flyer lies or the inconsistency that the ryegrass has. And you've heard players like Brooks that played and Horschel say, we want it tougher. I do. I just think, you know, they're a victim of more of the schedule than they are the condition of the golf course.
Yeah, I think they got the tougher side. PGA National this week, just look at the winning score. They lengthened number two as well. I think the conditions, you and I both saw how windy it was on Thursday and Friday. That certainly factors into this. I'm so happy I have you on the pod for this specific question. Since Brooks' return to the PGA Tour, going back to Torrey Pines, Scottsdale, and then last week, how have you seen the evolution of his putting? Has it changed dramatically, or do you think he's just more comfortable now?
You know, if you look at everything, we always look things in a tiny little lens. We don't look at big picture enough here, and we're micromanaging everything as we're supposed to do, I guess. But, you know, his sample size is pretty small, right? He came back and played at Torrey, and you were really worried when you saw how poorly he putted. And he didn't putt well at Phoenix, where he's, you know, played well before, obviously, and he's putted well. And then you all of a sudden, after round one, everybody's panicking. You know, he brought his old putting coach back, Jeff Pierce, who's from this area, and they had sought out the instruction of a bunch of other instructors, which you don't rarely ever see or hear about. And then he started to get a little bit more comfortable. He had a nice round to finish the event today, made a lot of birdies. And when I saw him on the practice round, in the Pro-Am on Wednesday, he said, look, it's not that big a deal. I'm trying too much at the same time. And we're going to analyze it. I know Brandel said he put his hands further forward. Jeff Pierce told me they're trying to keep a little bit more wrist action out of it and keep it more, you know, one simple motion. And he's going to find his way. I think we need Brooks Koepka, and Brooks Koepka needs the PGA Tour. And I don't think it's long before he's fighting and contending in major championships.
Fax, what's the biggest question you want answered during this Florida swing?
Well, I think, you know, we've seen glimpses of the best players in the world. We just haven't seen them together enough in the long term yet to see what's going to happen in this run up to the Masters. I think that frustratingly, these changes that we keep hearing about, that we're going to see more of the best players playing in smaller fields, I think that's going to take a lot longer than everybody thinks. But at the same time, you know, being more of a traditionalist too, I think having this finish at the Cognizant, there's something good about that. There's something good about that for the game of golf. And if you watch today, you walked away thinking, boy, there's some good young players out there. I want to know more about a lot of those guys. And you're going to pull harder for Shane Lowry the next time he plays. You're going to see if this win by Echevarria is this just a one-off? And then how do these guys that were, you know, circling around the leaderboard like Smotherman, do they keep showing up? And how can they contend as the coursers, the tournaments get, you know, more popular, the more familiar for the crowd? I love it.
Look at Fax, making us all smarter. Really appreciate your time, buddy. Thanks for joining.
You guys, always great to talk to you, and I'll see you up in Orlando for the API.
All right, Rex, it's time for the Voices in the Crowd segment. Thanks to all you guys who have been participating in this. Love hearing from you in the YouTube comment section. Keep it going. Hope to do it each and every week. Let's get started with our friend Joseph Boza, who said, Rex, our on-site media members like you mad when none of the superstars show up for tournaments like the Cognizant?
Not this on-site media member. I can be honest with you. I thoroughly enjoyed last week. And nothing against covering Scottie Scheffler and Rory and all of the top names. So we'll do that next week at Arnold Palmer's event. We'll do it the week after at the Players' Championship. The excitement level is so high. But I've said this a couple times on the podcast right now, and I cannot stress this enough. If you're looking for someone to root for, go to Austin Smotherman. He is not only one of the sweetest men on the planet, not only one of the most engaging interviews I've had in a really long time, he is a ball-striking machine. Sat and watched him on the range a couple times this week. He doesn't miss the middle of the club face, and he is starting to figure out his putting. He's working with Josh Gregory. I think he's a lovely fellow. He's easy to root for, and you don't get those stories at signature events. You don't necessarily get them at the major championships. You normally don't get them at the Players' Championship. This is what we talk about when meritocracy is in the conversation, about it's great to have these top players to carry the game, But every once in a while, and I'm not talking about every few years, I'm talking about every few weeks, to have a player like an Austin Smotherman or a Michael Brennan, or we can keep going, Jacob Bridgman just a few weeks ago. Keep going down the list. Those players make the game exciting and give fans another reason to tune in because suddenly you have someone else to root for.
Yeah, I think as a media member, you can somehow get into like a monotonous routine where what'd Scotty do today? What'd Rory do today? What did Tommy and Xander and Spieth do today? This is a great opportunity to cover events like the Cognizant, a great opportunity to meet new players, tell new stories, plan for the future, introduce the audience. These are the lifeblood of the PGA Tour. Yes, the stars get all the attention. The PGA Tour, though, is built on the middle class, promoting stars, elevating stars, just like the NFL and other sports do as well. How about this one, Rex from Oahu Golf Guy, who said, when discussing PGA Tour plans, all you guys do is reckless speculation, saying it's based simply on less is more. What say you?
I love that handle. That is a really good handle. I got to hand it to him. And we talked about this earlier in the show. I'm 100% on board with that idea. We don't know what's going to happen. I talked to a lot of guys, talked to a lot of officials, talked to a lot of people who know a lot more about the PGA Tour and where it might be heading than I do. And I think we have been a little premature. Less has been more. All you have to do is go back and listen to Tiger Woods' press conference that he gave in the Bahamas last year. Those were his words, not ours. And he is the chair of the Future Competitions Committee. So he sent this out into the universe. What has come back is a little bit of pushback from players. It's a little bit of pushback from media partners and corporate partners and everyone else who's involved in this conversation. I think we have to see how it plays out. And I think eventually there will be substantial change on tour, but we have to see how it plays out.
One thing we know for sure, and this was Lee Smith, the executive director of the Players Championship and an executive with the PGA Tour, who said PGA Tour is going to be focusing on three things next week at the Players Championship. There are three talking points. Start bigger, own the summer, head to bigger markets. Other than that, it is a little bit of speculation. We should know more, thankfully, in about 8 or 9 days. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. As a reminder, you guys can find us on golfchannel.com, Golf Channel YouTube page. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days.